Hey, everyone. Just Frank here for a second. Before we get to the episode, I just wanted to do a little housekeeping. We had a slight recording issue on one of the people participating in this episode. I will not say who it is, but basically for the first 5 or 6 minutes or so, their audio didn't end up recording, so we had to pull it from the Zoom we were recording from. So really embarrassing that this had to happen. Super unprofessional of the person who did it. And so it's only for the first couple minutes of the episode. I'm very excited about this episode. I think it came out really well. And I think you're in for a good conversation. And then, you know, a few minutes in, it'll get back on track. And we'll be providing the same high quality content that we always do. And to the person who messed up their audio because they didn't realize their mic wasn't plugged in, they should feel a lot of shame, and I'm sure they do. Okay, without further ado, here is our conversation on Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl.
And now, our feature presentation.
Does anyone feel strong about taking us in, or I can? It's up to you, I guess.
I think you should. This is a... Okay. We're going to be leaning on your expertise this time.
Yeah.
Okay. I will take, I don't have a lot of expertise, but I will take the helm. I will. I will
right. You have the con, Mr. Hanley.
Boo.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to No Flicks Given. I'm very excited for this episode because this is, I thought this was a guilty pleasure, but it's just a good movie. It's just a solid, solid movie.
Yeah.
We're going to be talking about the first Pirates of the Caribbean and only the first Pirates of the Caribbean. And to do that, I'm joined by Matt and Connor today. Matt, how are you?
I'm all right. I am unfortunately just drenched in sweat most of the day these days. That's the period of summer that we've reached.
Yeah, so. I'm getting, it's a tough time of year because with a podcast, you have to turn your AC off and you have to speak at like a Ben Shapiro speed to get everything out, to get the AC back on to survive New York and New Jersey in the summer.
It's pretty hot under these lights, Seinfeld. Pretty hot.
Actually, I'm quite comfortable.
Connor.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm great. I am thrilled to be back. I've been gone for a little while.
Good to have you back.
I think I wasn't on the Patriot episode, that much I know. And I don't, no, did you guys
you did
do anything?
Love listening to it, right?
I did
right?
love listening to it. Okay. I caught myself trying to interject like I would on the podcast. Like when Matt was going off on his historical tangents, I wanted
to say
hop.
It was a rant. It's fine.
I was trying to be a little bit more diplomatic.
If you had just recorded that, I would have thrown it on and basically like it would have been the three of us ignoring you.
just a long track of me going like, I just want to say
for the audience, it's like, guess who wasn't here? But yeah, so you missed the Patriot. I don't remember what we did before that. Indiana Jones. We did Dial of Destiny predictions, which as of recording this episode, I'm the only one to have seen the Dial of Destiny. So I know the correct answers to the predictions, and it's very interesting. But I can't say anything about it until the rest of you have watched it. So maybe a little bit before we record, which is fine. Most people, according to the box office, have not seen the movie either. So we have
to. Well, yeah. When's it going to be on streaming?
I would guess August, the first or second week of August.
Although honestly, Matt, I would love an excuse to sit in air conditioning for 4.5 hours.
I will say,
That's fair.
The only thing I'll spoil is I did enjoy it. It's not amazing, but it was perfectly fine. It is, it's really good for like a flight. Honestly, that's kind of what the movie is. Mm. But it's there's nothing that I hated the way Crystal Skull left you. So you'll be like, it's Disney-fied. It's a little Force Awakens a touch, but it's glossy. But that's it.
That's about all we could ask for. And I think that's kind of that's sort of where we ended the conversation. Was, you know, my hope is that it's fine.
I will say the only other thing, and I don't know if I texted you guys this, there's a moment late in the movie where it's
it's pretty by the numbers. It's paint by the numbers. Like, it's standard Indiana Jones. You pretty much get what's going on, what's happening here, there. But there's a moment late where something happens before, like, the last act that throws a twist into the plot so out of left field that for 90 seconds of this movie, you're going to sit there perked up and you're going to be like, holy shit, I legitimately have no idea what's about to happen in this film. And you're going to get so excited because of the possibilities of what you're about to experience.
And then they crush it.
They
and take the safe crush route
it in a good way.
They
go bananas a little bit in a very satisfying way. The movie, I think a lot of the reviews are more positive than they should be because it ends pretty great.
Because it bothers to take a swing.
It bothers to kind of take a swing. That's all I'll give it. I'm not going to. Most people are not watching this movie, so I don't want to spoil anything. But I did moderately enjoy myself. So anyway, that's not why we're here. We're talking about a different franchise that has been dug into the ground. Pirates of the Caribbean. We've been talking a lot about doing, summer movies that really get us in the mood for, you know, barbecues and the beach and all that stuff. And this has always been one of my summer movies, kind of the way like some people lump Lord of the Rings into like a Christmas or Thanksgiving movie for them. This is up there with like Jaws for me, where I like to watch it most summers. It's one of my favorite movies. And yeah, I was just really excited to talk to you guys about it because I haven't actually watched it in a couple of years, and I didn't know where everyone stood on this movie or this franchise. So here we are.
We've just crossed the 20th anniversary of its release.
Jesus. 20th anniversary, which is crazy. I know, right? And so I will mostly be praising this movie, though it has some severe faults that I will be happy to talk about. Yeah. But I do want to hear from you guys. Connor, had you thought of the movie, and then what did you think watching it this time?
So I saw it in theaters growing up. When it came out 2003, so I was in high school. Came out that summer, had a blast. Then was pleasantly surprised at the time because,
we all thought it was a joke.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a movie based on a Disneyland ride, which I guess they had tried to do the year before with The Country Bears, which is a movie I don't think anybody's actually seen.
Oh God, I forgot that was first, and then they bothered to do this.
Yeah, and then they did The Haunted House later, which I never saw.
Yeah.
The Haunted Mansion. Yeah, thank you. So saw it in high school, was a little dubious going in, but and I don't even think I had seen a trailer, honestly. My memory of seeing this movie is a little fuzzy. I saw it with friends, and I was, you know, sort of that age where it was like, you know, group of boys and girls and stuff like that, and there was like hormones and stuff. And had an amazing time, was pleasantly surprised, really enjoyed it. And I must have seen it since then. I don't have any firm memories of watching it. It's certainly not a movie that I have returned to much, if at all, since then. The second two movies in that original trilogy just kind of left me a little cold. I never saw the other. How many? There's like five. There's of
five
these?
Total. Five.
Yeah. And the other two just went right over my head. Watched it last night and had a fucking blast. I love this movie. As I've matured as a like appreciator of film since then as well, like I almost enjoyed it more this time watching it, appreciating it for the craft and for the craziness of it, and also the simplicity of it story-wise. You know, they're not, it's before a time where you had to build a shit ton of lore into your projects, and you could just be like, this is the scenario, these are the characters, away with it, off we go. And it's a, you know, rip roaring adventure, good time. And, you know, my crush that I had on Keira Knightley when I was that age continues to now.
That's fair.
It's funny too, because it's, I remember back being like, oh, it's like the big CGI movie. It's like the big glossy blockbuster. And you look back and you're like, man, it's quaint and it's down and dirty and it's so like film grainy in like a lot of, like it's just.
It is.
Like the,
that was the like the first thing I noticed actually was the film grain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's crazy how well this has sort of aged into like more of a classic looking film, and how well the CGI is held up, I'll say.
Yeah,
Matthew.
I mean, this was a favorite of mine growing up. Saw it in theaters.
How did I know?
I mean, like
you enjoy a movie with boats,
right? Yeah,
and codes,
and just like. Yeah, this was, I mean, you know, we bought it on DVD and would just watch it when we had nothing better to do at home. And, you know, the sequels did leave a sour taste in my mouth towards the end of high school. And then I think I probably dropped off watching it as regularly. But this is one of those movies. It's a movie very much like a part of a franchise where you almost wish they had just left it at one, like not unlike The Matrix. And it's just revisiting it now is just, oh man, this is, it's just a solid movie. And the fact that I did not realize that it's 2.5 hours long, and it's 2.5 hours long, but it's so well paced that it doesn't, at least from my perspective, watching it now, does not really drag in any point. It's mm-hmm. just constantly moving and you're always engaged in what's going on the screen. It's a throwback.
Oh, yeah. It's a throwback while still, like, modernize it. And the way, like, Cutthroat Island a few years before was a throwback.
And almost killed the genre.
It almost killed the genre. But I love that movie, but
I love that movie, too.
It immediately was pretty dated in how it sort of was perceived versus this is so sleek and modern with, like, I mean, the score does a lot of work for it, but...
The score.
We'll talk about it, but... I'll say too, plot wise, I do think it drags a touch, mostly because it's structurally built in a weird way where there's like a false finale where you know the finale has to take place in the middle, and then it keeps going when they first go there, and it's like the fake out curse lifting with Keira Knightley, and you're like, well, you know the end has to be kind of like a repeat of this, and it's not bad because the story wise it makes sense, but you're like a little just visually you're like, okay, we got to the end of the movie place, like it feels weird. we're leaving it and we have to come back an hour later. And then also, as amazing as the undead skeletons are, there's a lot of why are they fighting these people, like there's a lot of like that energy to it at times where it's like, we're wasting time just having awesome fights that won't resolve anything because they can't.
So what now, Jack Sparrow? Are we to be two immortals locked in an epic battle until Judgment Day and the trumpets sound?
Or you could surrender.
That portion, though, I think is more of the, like, it's the movie factor of does it look cool? Then it doesn't matter.
Yeah. I know. And that's why I forgive almost all of it.
It's like a dance sequence in the middle of a musical.
Yes.
It's there because you kind of have to have it. Mm-hmm. And because it's awesome, because it's fun to look at. And also, like, I had a similar reaction of sort of thinking it through almost, you know, and it's the same thing of well, these pirates are undead and we can't really resolve this fight with, you know, people being dead. But also, like, Orlando Bloom doesn't know that. He doesn't know the rules.
Well,
he doesn't,
yeah,
he doesn't know the rules.
Yeah, there's a little, like, who knows what, when.
Yeah.
I also think it's... I've seen it so many times, it's not... It's always clear to me, but if you're just watching this fresh, the rules of the curse are, like, just a little too... Maybe not too complicated, but too poorly explained early on enough to the audience, where you need the blood of this person, but they don't make it clear that it's, like... The rest of them have sort of like have added their blood and put all the coins in. They made it seem like this is the only blood that is needed. Like, it's just a little bit where it's like, it's just clunky exposition lines that I think just sort of block.
I think they also let you fill in your own gaps a little bit as well. Because you kind of assume that, because he says we've spent, you know, however many, a decade going around collecting these coins. You got to assume that all the pirates have put their blood into the thing as well.
Yeah.
And they're just waiting to find bootstrap bills.
I know, but then they get, there's one part that stuck out to me that I get why they did it this way. There's the scene where Will, we'll get into the plot. I just want to sort of complain about this. Where Will is with Elizabeth after they've sort of rescued her and they're in the hull of the ship running from the Black Pearl. And he realizes that they need his blood to lift the curse. Mm-hmm. And they add a character line in there where he has to come to grips with the fact that he's got the blood of a pirate in him. Mm-hmm. But he says the blood of a pirate within the exposition of how the curse works. And it switches gears from like explaining the rules of the curse to explaining how he feels emotionally as a character. And you're like, wait, they need just like pirate blood, or they need like it just, yeah. It's a line that sort of, if you read it wrong and if you're not sort of folk dialed in enough to like what they're doing, you're like, wait, they need any pirate blood? Like what is that? Like, it just can throw you off.
They also treat being a pirate as like a familial genetic disease or something.
A little bit, yeah. They also treat being a pirate as like 60s hippies kind of thing, where it's like, ah, yeah, you're just free, man. And you're like, no, you're raping and murdering. Like, it's not quite as romantic as you're trying to make it, but I get what you're doing.
The history of piracy is fascinating, which I imagine
and violent at some point. And horrible and terrible, but this is so
one of the first real democracies.
That's funny. We have to talk about that. I really liked the story, though, this time around. Usually you're like, oh, that's the Johnny Depp movie. That's like he saves it and the rest is sort of like bland. But like, there's a lot of fun stuff. The opening scene in the fog and with the kids. And
I forgot that it started that way.
Yeah, yeah. You really forget. But like, it goes full ghost story. And then like that creepy shot of the umbrella floating in the water. Like, it really does hit on some serious tones before it gets silly. So you really have a base level of how serious the movie's going to be at its core.
It's also, though, one of the earlier movies, and we kind of glazed over, but the Mummy and Mummy Returns being two of those movies as well, where it's taking it seriously, but then also there's little like pings of humor in it that it's the beginning of what we see now with where everything is just jokey and doesn't take anything seriously. It's before all that. It's just the beginning of the introduction of the drama cutting humor of just, but in my opinion, being appropriately introduced to sort of set a tone of like, it's serious, but don't take it too seriously.
Right.
I think you just stole my hot take I was going to lay on you guys, which is that this is like one of the origins of the MCU. Like, dead on. Yeah.
And something that just occurred to me while we were talking is this is sort of the last of the great 90s blockbusters.
Mm.
If you think about like that era of like Independence Day and Twister and Mission Impossible and things like that, like there were these sort of like standalone movies that came out, weren't necessarily based on a property, but some were, and they were supposed to be one movie, self-contained. They weren't marketing the next movie that would come along. It was, you know, right around the era of like Spider-Man and stuff, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't big franchise filmmaking yet. And like I said, what this sort of like sparks off from the lore thing that I said earlier, it's not about building lore or building a world. It's literally about, you know, setting up your world as quickly as possible, placing your characters in it, and just having them do stuff.
Yeah, it's in that era where like anything lore wise is just for this movie's benefit.
Yes.
And then it makes the sequels, they shoot themselves in the foot a couple times because they have to then be like, well, now we have to like make it work with it.
Yeah.
It's like
yeah.
the Back to the Future 2 stuff where it's like, all right, now we have to like work with the rules we made without thinking ahead. It's funny you say that too, because originally this was just called Pirates of the Caribbean for most of the marketing. Like the first trailer for this movie doesn't even have the subtitle on it. And like 4 or 5 months before it came out, Disney was so happy with how it was looking and how it was, they thought it was going to hit. Eisner and Bruckheimer were like, let's add a subtitle so that it feels like the first of a franchise. And Gore Verbinski hated that. And they came to the agreement. I kind of hate it. I don't think it's a good subtitle either. But
I mean, I just refer to this one as Pirates of the Caribbean. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he hated it because, like, the curse is not the ship. It's the goal. Like, he's like, it doesn't make sense. But they were like, fine, we'll make a deal with you where, like, we'll have it on there, but it will make it as small as we can, like, legally have it look on the poster.
God.
Yeah, I love it as just, like, Pirates of the Caribbean, like, the movie.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That's it. I mean, and that's really, frankly, having thought about the franchise that it spawned, is all it ever should have been.
Yeah.
Dude, okay, we can briefly touch on it, because I do think there's some fun stuff in the second one.
Dead Man's Chest. Yeah.
Yeah. And three has some, like, well-made
three is fucking aspects. Bonkers.
Three is weird. I don't totally understand. Well,
they split one movie into two movies. That's the problem. Like, if you cut out all of
for the Matrix, Connor, right?
Yeah.
Well, if you cut out all the crap in the last two movies, you have one perfectly fine film, you know?
Well, they literally were like, I remember the writers talk about this on the commentary for the second movie, which there's a commentary of the writers on the first movie that is, if anyone's interested in screenwriting, is great, because they talk through, there's four writers on it, and each of them was involved in the script at different stages of it. And they talk about their parts of it, where one guy was like, I wrote the script so early on, there was nothing supernatural in it. And another one talked. Yeah. So there's, like, different pieces where you see who kind of brought in what and went through. Cause this movie, the script has been floating around since, like, the early 90s. At one point, like, Spielberg was going to make this with, like, Steve Martin. And, like, it went through a lot of weird iterations. But with the sequels, at least two and three, the writers were like, well, we had a crossroads after the first one hit, where we're like, we can do one of two things. Either we go the Indiana Jones route and James Bond, where everyone is a standalone adventure and we have the same characters appear, which I think was probably the better option. But the problem with that is, like, it's hard to do that with more than one character. That's, like, then you really, it's hard to bring back everybody every time. For different reasons, you'd have to basically just follow Jack Sparrow. But and then the other thing was, like, make it Lord of the Rings, make it a single trilogy that, like, everything kind of connects back and it's a single storyline. But then you have to, like, retrofit. It works better than Matrix as far as not feeling like the first one is so disconnected. But it's still, it doesn't work because you clearly did not lay the track to.
And I mean, like, there's portions of the sequels that I enjoy, like, just having Davy Jones as a character.
Davy Jones
great.
Is great.
That Kraken. Could have been its own standalone thing, is Davy Jones and his ship. Like, that's it.
Sure.
That's, like, and then they have to deal with it, but it doesn't have to be related to, like, anybody's prior history.
Dude, do you know the MacGuffin of the fifth movie? Do you guys know where we end up?
I did
and
not
how
watch them
messy
after the third.
The lore of Pirates of the Caribbean gets. I've seen all of them. The fifth movie is about they have to find Poseidon's trident, because what it does, and I swear to God the movie has the balls to say this.
No.
What it does is you can undo every active curse that is currently, like, happening in the world. So basically it's like a hard reset, because they had gotten so out of hand with, like, all these ghosts and weird shit that they're like, what if we just have it be a thing where they do it, and then it makes it so everything is clean again. But, and you're like, wow. Yes. That's real.
Yeah, no, I know.
No. Not interested in that story.
I think that's the thing, is, like, every character that I enjoy thoroughly in this film is perfect only because, one, they don't overstay their welcome. And two, we only know exactly
what we need
as much about them that we need to. And it's like, I don't care what happened to Jack Sparrow before the events of this movie.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't, he was a pirate. He crewed the ship, lost the ship. And now he's trying to get the ship back, because his obsession with the Black Pearl is seconded only by, like, Jim Kirk's obsession with the Enterprise. Like, that's it. And that's his character thing. Cool. Barbossa is just this great villain.
Great.
Who's like, like, has this little weird, like, aspiring to high culture thing, but also just has you know, no sense of propriety. And just, like, I don't care who his dad was or where he came from or what he was doing before this. All that matters is his position in this story, and that's it. And it's great. It's a great arc. Once you start trying to tack shit onto it is where it starts to just get bogged down by its own weight.
It's too tightly tightly knit as a character movie. And that's kind of an interesting about this, even though there is a MacGuffin and there is a, it's not a, like, we have to do this to save the world and we're all just people doing it. It's like the movie only ends when every character's arc
gets
completed.
Yeah.
Keira Knightley wants to be with Pirate. Well, you know, they all have their piece that wraps up and fulfills them as like as a character. And then you have to unravel that for sequels with it.
Isn't it great, guys, to have a movie where the stakes are not the end of the world?
Yeah, it's really lovely.
It's really nice. I mean, they're literally just trying to undo the curse has already happened. It's just literally it's putting gold back. I mean, it's nice and simple.
And the stakes are so character driven. It's like,
yeah,
it's Jack Sparrow wants his boat back. Keira Knightley gets kidnapped, so they have to. Will Turner has to go get her back. Done. Movie. That's the movie.
That's it.
And
the pirates want to lift the curse, but the pirates are also genuinely super duper evil.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Norrington wants to be with Elizabeth, and he's the only one who like actually is like, no, I'm going to rise above my own wants and like,
God,
he's the only good guy.
I love him as a character.
What a character.
He's great. Another botched in the sequels role. But yeah, he's a lot of fun in this.
Well, and Elizabeth's father, Governor Swan, is great in this.
That's the moment that got me the hardest this time was when, after the curse is lifted and they save the day, when he just joins the celebration as if he was just as involved. And he like shadow boxes that one guy as he's going by, like wags his finger. It's great.
Well, like looking at the hand in the drawer after the curse is lifted and being disgusted.
You know, it's just an arm now. Like all the meat is back on the arm.
It's a lot of fun.
Like all that's great, but like that's all you need from that character.
Yeah.
And like,
no,
great. Like I don't need, and it's the same Hollywood problem as everything of just like more and more and more and more and more until you're
just
sick of it.
Milk it until turning grapes into raisins. But
can we talk about Norrington for a little bit?
Yes.
Of course.
Nobody has done more with less, I think, than Jack Davenport with this character. First of all, this goes back to our theory that Matt and I share that a trained British professional it can do anything.
Yeah.
Mm. Also, the guy's name is Jack. Because
he's theater, right?
He's British. He's theater. He's on a lot of British TV. I first saw him on a British miniseries called Ultraviolet, which is about essentially vampire cops in London.
Sure.
Which is the most Connor TV show. There has never been a more Connor TV show. Also, the guy's name is Jack Davenport. He's just the most British man you could. He
almost
ever.
A better name for the character than the character's name.
Yeah. Like Commodore Norrington is very British, but like Jack Davenport is also exceedingly British.
His first name is Jack, though. He's Commodore Jack Norrington.
Yeah,
you just couldn't call him Jack because Jack Sparrow's in it.
Yeah.
But I was fascinated in this watch through watching his interactions with everybody, especially with his interactions with Will Turner, because he's playing the class of it all, like the class differences. In a way that I don't even necessarily think was written in the script, but it's just something that Jack Davenport would be aware of, that he's, you know, he's high born and, you know,
he's a gentleman and Will is a blacksmith.
Exactly. Yeah. And he takes himself and his job very seriously, but he also, takes the responsibility of it very seriously. He cares a lot about doing his job well and making sure that the people that are with him are safe. The moment where he tells the governor to barricade himself in the office, and the way that he treats Will after the big attack on the town, where he's like, "I know you're upset. We're handling this. You need to not be a part of this, please. Don't
make the mistake of thinking you're the only one." He didn't have to say that. Comforted him a little bit.
Exactly. And also was like, I'm taking you seriously as another adult. I know what you want to do. Don't, because it's not going to help, you know? I really had a lot of appreciation for that performance this time around, which is another sort of like, now that I'm a grown up, I see that in a way that I wouldn't have as a teenager.
Yeah. Nine times out of 10, the character would come off as unlikable.
Yeah.
But also, nine times out of 10, you would write this type of character as a, like, non-violent antagonist, yeah. a like authority figure only. Mm-hmm. And they went the extra length where it's like, no, no, we want to like this guy. And it's yeah. kind of like more complicated because you don't want to see him, like you don't want to see him get hurt, but you know you want Will to be with, you know, that whole thing. It's kind of the, what's his name from Casablanca, that very similar to that guy, the freedom fighter, whose name I always fucking blank on.
Klaus.
The third leg of the triangle. Frenchy.
Yeah,
well, but yeah, the actor. But yes, yes.
French, Latin based, of course. Inventors of mayonnaise,
or not mayonnaise.
And honestly, I think that the script was written for that, to have him be this sort of nonviolent antagonist type. And I might be giving Jack Davenport more credit than is due, but I think that it's the performance of those lines as written that really gives mm-hmm. the character that kind of humanity.
I think so. But I do want to talk about the drunken pirate in the room, which is Jack Sparrow. This is the tale of Captain Jack Sparrow, pirate so brave on the seven seas.
What?
Going back to the roots of what made this guy work is so fun, and it's crazy how much of a misfire this was 4 times in a row after he made this movie.
Well, it's overexposure.
Overexposure. It's also, this was not written to be performed like this. This was written like a regular Errol Flynn.
Yeah.
And then he does that performance, and that balances it out, versus like the sequel, you write him to be goofy and silly and losing his balance, and he plays it that way. It's way too oversaturated in one direction, versus this, like when he's serious in this, it really helps adjust your emotional journey through the character.
Well, it's the same, like when they're in the cave, it's a very similar moment to the one that he had with Davenport, where he's like, I know what I'm doing and you don't. Please don't get involved. Don't fuck this up. You know, I understand that you're very heavily emotionally invested in what's going on, but I know how to handle this and you don't.
Perfect use of, these are the moments you can be funny and these are the moments you have to be serious. And I'm sure that was a collaboration between writer, director, and actor to sort of find those pieces, and it always works well.
Well, and he always has the Jack Sparrow edge to it.
Yeah.
He's just dialing it. You know, not all the way, not ever all the way to zero, but if he knocks it down to like a 2. Now back to the good part.
I do think a very important tiny, tiny moment that helps is, and this is kind of a good thing to remember when you have a movie that has this sort of ever-shifting emotional tones, is before, because as soon as Jack Sparrow enters the movie, it's a whole other fucking ballgame. It's a whole other frequency. But
that character introduction might be one of my favorites in all of cinema.
It's a perfect
history.
It's a perfect scene. The reveal that it's a tiny little boat is just,
and that it's half underwater.
He doesn't say a word, and it's sinking, and the fact that he has somehow found a way where he's always, you're immediately like, he's always going to be down on his luck, but he'll be fine, because the boat sinks just as he needs to. And he's probably been sailing for like 2 weeks and he's like the exact amount of inches he needs to get to port.
Well, and then further on from that, the interaction that he has with the harbor master, where it's like, it's a shilling to park here, you know, and register your, and like that interaction is so, that's so dialed in, and it's so focused and disciplined in a way that I think a lot of the further Jack Sparrow performances were not.
Well, he plays it drunk in the other movies, and he's not drunk in this. Like, it's,
well, and the other thing too is that it's the shift in how his character is proportioned in the later movies, where he becomes more of like the primary protagonist in all which isn't, his character should be a protagonist in a group, in an ensemble. But it's the same problem of like, if you take Star Wars and then in Empire Strikes Back, you spend the entire time with Han Solo and then like 15 whole minutes of screen time with Luke, and people are like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Well, it helps to, you're always, I mean, I think you always know he's going to be a good guy, but like, it helps to not totally know where he's at with what he's doing. And you can only really do that the one time.
But, And the other thing in this movie is that he is never caught flat-footed, really. In that, like a handful of times he's caught, like once when he gets marooned again. But like, he's usually in some semblance of control of the situation that he's in, or he's orchestrated some part of the scenario that he's in, where you can't do that if he's going to be the primary protagonist in the other film. So he always has to be kind of a little bit more down on his luck, and that defeats the purpose of the character, of kind of what we were talking about with his introduction, where like his timing is perfect, like he knows his luck is hitting him right where he needs it to be.
Yeah, everything goes wrong except the one thing he needs to go right.
Yeah. And that can't happen if he's going to be struggling through four more movies.
And the other thing too, like, he's an expert in the world that we're in.
Yes.
Like, he's lived in it his entire life. He knows how everything's going to play out, which is how he stays in control, is like knowing the rhythms of like every interaction he's going to have.
Yeah.
In the further movies, when they expand the world out, suddenly he's not an expert in the world around him. And
he has to be explained things.
Yeah.
You're the main character. Yeah.
And it diminishes the character.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I forgot who wrote it, but I remember a review when I think At World's End came out, where someone kind of hit the nail on the head, where it's like, in the first movie, he was a trickster pretending to be a fool. And in the later movies, he's a fool pretending to be a trickster.
Yeah.
Like, the balance is off, where it to some degree, how he, his like swagger is a bit of a like way to bring people's guard down, and it's more of a strategy than actually he's like, because he can kind of turn that off when he needs to. So it is a little bit of like play up the goofiness to really like make people underestimate you.
Yeah, it's the contrast of when they go to Tortuga and he wakes up Mr. Gibbs and does the whole thing about if the man who does the waking buys the man who is doing the sleeping a drink and blah, blah, and then goes through that whole proposal of what he's doing and how he's saying it, like the language of it, and then compare it with the I got a jar of dirt chant in the third movie. Like that's
pretty good.
Yeah.
Like, that's pretty good.
That's the problem.
But with his introduction, one thing that this movie was smart to throw in there, because it's a pretty straightforward, serious film in the opening scene and then the scene of Elizabeth waking up and going, everything until Jack Sparrow comes in. It's a complete like shift in what type of movie it's going to be. But the director threw in this tiny little beat where Will is looking at a candlestick on the wall and he just pulls it out. And it's the smallest little joke, but... Gore Verbinski was like, it tells the audience it's okay to laugh so that they're ready when Jack Sparrow like goes ham with it. Otherwise, it'd be really aggressive to just know nothing's like amusing or funny. And then suddenly he's like, he does that opening scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he's also not a clown in this movie. You know, he becomes a clown later. I mean, this may just be restating everything we've said up to this point, but... You know, he like you said, like his silliness is a tactic to help him be successful in the life that he chooses. The interesting thing to me that also gets lost later on is Elizabeth falls in the water and he just jumps right in.
Yeah.
He like the first thing the third thing you see him do. You know, his boat sinks. He's trying to con these guards, and then he rescues somebody. Like just a without hesitation act of heroism.
Proud of the King's Navy, you are. Do not lose these.
Best dive in any movie.
Yeah, great diver.
And then they made me their chief.
Right. I mean,
so well, good.
Yeah, and like this character in this movie has so many layers to him.
Yes.
That get flattened out in the movies to come. But there is this sort of sense of that Captain Jack is kind of there to take care of Will and Elizabeth a little bit. Like he's just decided that's a thing that he is wants to do. Again, sort of in further movies, he just becomes a, you know, purely selfish jerk as time goes on.
And I think that was something that I noticed on this rewatch of having my perception colored by the sequels and his behavior in the sequels, of thinking that like he's more self-serving generally. But this movie, like he's does not want to kill people. Like he doesn't want Will to die. Like he goes out of his way to try to save people's lives.
Everybody. Yeah.
And just goes about it in a way that makes him, he's like still trying to like present pirate, but earnestly has a good heart. And like, that's something that I think really comes out in this movie that may get lost later on.
Yeah,
and I think 100%. That's the core of what makes the character great in this one.
Well, I think too, it's not just him in the sequels. They do this thing where no one is likable. Will, Elizabeth, and Jack all kind of dislike each other in 2 and 3.
Yeah, there's that too, yeah.
And they're all betraying each other. And it's like, imagine after Star Wars, they made Empire and Return of the Jedi, and Han, Luke, and Leia constantly did not care for each other and constantly tried to betray each other while fighting the Empire.
That's the lesson they got wrong, was somebody watched Empire and they're like, oh yeah, Han and Leia are always bickering in that movie. So like, everyone should be bickering because that's the fun of Empire Strikes Back. And so it's that the dumb Hollywood mistake shit that happens when you turn a one great movie into a franchise.
Yeah, learning all the wrong lessons and also just not watching it right, you know?
Yeah, mm-hmm. But that's one of the strengths of this film, is like getting the tone pretty well and just like it being very character focused. And I think that it is helped by the fact that like the stakes are not world ending. It's very much just like the stakes are important to the characters that we are spending time with. And like, that's what matters. Yeah.
But when you need to be worried, the movie's good at making sure. When she falls in that water and it's a funny little moment where her dress is too tight and suddenly the medallion like booms.
Yeah,
you're like, oh shit!
And the
what
wind
is that?
Changes.
The wind
That's
changes.
A very
and
then cool moment.
The sky. Yeah. If you look, it's kind of hard to notice, but the sky is like the clouds form like a hand coming towards her in the background of a shot. Like it's pretty good. And then the attack on the town is just great. Great
stuff. That's brutal.
Yeah.
In a way that I didn't remember it being, you know, like in my memory, it was more of like the moment from the actual Pirates of the Caribbean ride where it's like the pirate and the women sort of going in the circle forever.
Oh,
It is way more, you know, brutal and violent than I remember.
Yeah. They do a good job making the pirates scary, making the skeletons scary looking.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was the thing I noticed this time, too. They introduced the skeleton aspect of it way earlier than I thought. And it's almost kind of a throwaway moment where Jack's like, that's a new element. Yeah. And also the subtle introduction that these guys can't die when Will Turner hits the bomb throwing pirate with the axe. And then he's just back later in
a very distinct looking guy to make that work without any lines of dialogue about it. And you're just like, wait a minute. I thought, like, because you're just as confused as Will at that moment. It's pretty good. Yeah. Mostly it just works well. But then there's just, I think it's literally just a matter of the last bit of exposition when the two goofball pirates are throwing, they're telling the story of how Bootstrap dies is just too late. We don't need it there. We need that earlier to understand the last piece of how this all works and why they need the blood of this person. Like, it just feels it's a good scene and a good story and it's done well, but it's just too late into the movie for like the last piece where it's like, you've already been given information that you needed that to really make that stick. And it's also the part when people sort of complain about it dragging a little bit, is because like, it slows down just when most movies would be working to ramp up, and it gets back up again. But there is a pretty long lull after what acts like a finale.
Yeah, I mean, having thought about it, it does sort of take a little bit of the oomph away from the climax of the movie because we're seeing the same thing again. The thing is, I didn't feel that watching it. I'm feeling that thinking about it now. 12 hours later, but in the experience of actually watching the movie, I didn't find it distracting or anything. Just kind of
because you know you have to go back to that place.
Yeah, we've been conditioned to sit through 2.5 hour movies like it's the norm, and 3 hour movies even.
Yeah,
that aren't like Titanic epics. Like it's just like the latest Batman is 3 hours. Great, I'm sure it's going to be great. And then this was at a time where like 2.5 hours for like a movie like this is like, that's indulgent a little bit. Like
you got one of those a summer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Until
other than like
a
Lord of the Rings or something. Yeah. Which, as big as this was only the fourth highest grossing movie of 2003, because it was just like jam packed with Return of the King. And then I think maybe Azkaban is in there. It's a few big franchise movies.
2003 would have been Chamber of Secrets, I think, or did they?
No, first one is a one. I think they did like a one a year for a little bit there, yeah, but maybe I'm wrong.
That's nuts.
It's like every 18 months or something.
And yeah, the I mean, I love after he rescues her, his escape attempt is the first, like, I don't know. It's the first sort of balance of like funny action. It's like the first action scene in the movie.
Yeah.
And you sort of get a sense of like how silly this can get as far as like the zaniness. I love that whatever, I don't even know how anything works, but he's spinning on that fucking rope on top. And it's just, it's hilarious while being like really heroic with like a type of score that.
Yeah. I think that's too, like, speaking of like our discussion with the Patriot in the last episode of just how much the score can have an effect on the tone of a film.
Yeah.
How I don't want to say seminal because a lot of it copies Gladiator, but how much of a cornerstone of a certain period of time and a certain genre of film this particular score is.
Yes. Well, I will. You said the magic word, so I'm going to take us on a few minutes of a journey.
Please do.
Through how much this score rips off of other movies. I've got a whole presentation set. Let me get ready here.
Hans Zimmer reusing his own work.
Zimmer, and I know it's kind of in house because all the other people he's ripping off are. But
isn't it credited to Klaus Badelt?
Yes, oh, right. But I don't. Something happened where.
Oh no,
there was
something
sort of fallout.
Yeah, because Hans takes over for the rest of it.
Hans takes over, and I think it went to Klaus's head, and I think Hans sort of like I remember they finished the movie the day before the world premiere.
Good
and
Lord.
It was like they needed to pull everybody in to get everything done, and it was like especially the music is the last piece of that in a lot of ways. And like I think Hans Zimmer did a lot of thankless work on this score, and I don't think Klaus or anybody really gave him a lot of credit, so he made sure to get his for the sequels. But let's take you guys on a little journey. Some of these you'll know, and then a few of them I've kind of found, and maybe I'll surprise you with some of these. So, okay. So I'm going to play. Here's how it's going to work. I'm going to play the Pirates track, and then I'm going to play a movie that came up before Pirates of the Caribbean that it seems to have stolen from. So here's the first one. And then this is Armageddon. That's admissible.
Yeah, I don't know how that didn't turn out to be a lawsuit. Well, I guess because it's technically
Hans Zimmer's in the
group.
Well, and Hans Zimmer loves that kind of, I don't even know what the technical term is.
That chord progression?
That chord progression, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Here's the next one. And this is, I know this is from Dead Man's Chest, but it's a theme from the first movie. It's a better track. All right. And here's the Road to El Dorado. All right, next one, back to Pirates.
Oh, this is,
you know the one coming.
Mm-hmm. I know the one coming.
This is the most egregious one.
Yeah.
This is the most egregious one by far. I mean, I don't even, it's Gladiator, it's Hans Zimmer, so.
Yeah.
I guess it's fine.
It's the James Horner thing. Like he just, you know.
All right. Last one that I think neither of you will know. This is from Dead Man's Chest, but still, they just keep going with it. Here's the Davy Jones theme from Dead Man's Chest.
Thank you.
here is the bad
General
guy theme
Mandible
from Ants.
Oh, wow.
Oh, this one's pretty egregious, too.
Your Honor, the prosecution rests.
The thing, though, is that at least the orchestrations of it for Pirates, to me, just have that little extra spice to it that, for me, makes them more enjoyable to listen to.
Oh, I mean, Pirates improves upon every one of those, I think.
Yeah, I mean, he takes all of them and makes them sound like they're in a pirate movie.
Yeah, which is why they're better.
I would love to know the origin of that sound, of like why pirate movies sound that way. This is not an answer that I expect either of you to have, necessarily.
Well, I mean, because it's
Irish-English.
Yeah, it's the chieftain's folk. There has to be a folk element to it, you know what I mean?
Because he pulls in a Germanic, Holst kind of, yeah.
Well, he makes it marchy, because he loves a march.
Makes it marchy and waltzy, especially.
But, I think the thing that, regardless of the severe borrowing.
Commandeer. We're going to commandeer Nautical Town.
I grew up listening to film scores that's I would buy I owned these albums on CD when they came out, and that was the music that I listened to, and the pirate scores were the rock albums for me to rock out to, that's just regardless, they're bangers.
For even people who don't listen to movie soundtracks, every one of those pieces I'd played, if I played them for anyone else, they'd be like, oh, that's Pirates of the Caribbean. It cemented itself as a thing that, outside of John Williams scores and a few other big classics, Pirates of the Caribbean is so iconic that it eclipsed a sound that had already been in Hollywood since Drop Zone, Crimson Tide. What's the earliest Hans Zimmer sort of went to that well?
Yeah. Crimson Tide, I think, is the earliest big, you know.
In college, the Pirates theme was the hype up song before basketball games.
Yeah.
And it hypes you. It really does. Drop Zone is before Crimson Tide. I think that is the earliest I've found the classic Hans Zimmeriness.
That phase of his composing before he just fell asleep on his organ.
I know. I mean, he does good stuff now, but wait, I want to. I'll play this is. I mean, I don't have an exact ripoff for this, but this is Pirates basically, but it's Drop Zone from '94.
Oof. Oh, I mean, yeah.
Wait a minute, what?
Have you both seen this movie?
I've not seen the movie, no.
It's not. This is the best thing in the movie.
Oh, this was this was a popular trailer song.
It's in the Pirates trailer too.
Oh, is it?
But yeah.
In the movie, it's very out of place too, because you're like, whoa, that's a sound I've never quite heard before in a Hollywood film. But
yeah, I mean, to me, it's just but the pirate score, I think, just is the perfect confluence of all of his shit. One of my favorite pieces of music of all time, forever, regardless, will be Barbossa is Hungry from the album from the Pirates.
Oh, great, great track.
That moment where it ramps up and then just lulls into this chase sequence portion.
Yeah.
That whole thing is great.
The drums, especially that, it's really fun, and he does a lot of modern sort of instrumentation weaved within the classical. It was the perfect sound to put in the movie to tell audiences no, it's okay to watch a pirate movie. It's gonna be cool. It's not your dad's pirate movie, which is funny because I believe Alan Silvestri was originally writing music for it, and now we're back to The Patriot. But and I've never been able to find it. Don't ask. I've looked forever. I can't even find sheet music of what Alan Silvestri wrote, because he was replaced with the Hans Zimmer engine for Pirates 1. And I think it's because he did the same thing that we've seen a lot in this time, where it's more classical of a score, or the same with Troy. Gabriel Ured did a very old school, which I prefer actually to James Horner but like a very old school classic sword and sandal score that he was replaced like a month before the film came out because it just it aged it too well. And you really want to like invite in a modern layman audience to it.
That, of the legacies of this film, the score is probably one of the most
score and
core
and,
ones.
And Johnny Depp's performance. So like really the rest is good, but those two things like just blow it away.
And arguably the score has survived the onslaught of pirates movies better than Captain Jack Sparrow did.
Oh yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And even the reputation and of the score, I feel like has weathered time a little bit better than Johnny Depp as a as
well, there's
actor.
That too. Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean it's too good. I mean it's the same thing with like John Williams doing the prequels where no one, despite everything with those movies, no one's like, John Williams fucking crushed it. And this the prequel music is praised as highly as it deserves to be because it's just, you can separate. You can see like how good this element was.
Yeah, it's great music. The nice thing though is that in this movie, it's paired with a just a really solidly made summer blockbuster. Like that's, you know.
Yeah.
That's really it. It's
they blew up another ship.
That's a great explosion too, which I don't think it's a model. I think that's a real ship they blow up.
Oh, I don't know. I didn't look at this
up. I think that's a real ship. It looks really, that's the thing with this movie. It's like Jurassic Park 1 and then this, as far as like CGI that has just aged pretty damn well.
Oh yeah.
Where like, you know, when it's a CGI skeleton, but like, God damn, do they look way better than they should for 2003?
Oh, just the shot of them walking under the water, under the keel of the ship is like, that's still great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and to me, the real magic trick of the whole thing is during the sword fights when there's like little beams of moonlight coming in and they're transitioning from human looking people to skeleton people, you know, as they pass through it's the perfect. Border of the moonlight. That's pitch perfect. There is not a single flaw. I mean, I'm sure if we went frame by frame, you could see some stuff. But like watching it, I don't think I've seen anything like that executed as well. Sense.
No.
And what a genius idea too, just as far as like staging a fight goes, having those little effects in there to and it's a pretty good sword fights too.
It's good sword
you know,
it's a great set. It's a great
set. Yeah,
cave set.
Now that was the thing that I was going to ask Frank was after this movie, is there really any other good sword fight, like choreographed sword fight
within the world
in this swashbuckling sense, like in the history of like Robin Hood and like going all the way up through here?
It's more in like Eastern cinema still is doing a lot of like Jet Li has some good ones in like Hero and Fearless.
Swashbuckling though.
I mean the actual sword fights in this are pretty okay. It's really like you don't care at all about like what the choreography is of the actual sword combat. It's just it stands in for like the blocking of like think of the Will and Jack fight in the blacksmith shop. Like they're just hitting swords. You don't even really need to see what they're doing, but how they move through that space is really well done.
It's a very classical when it comes to actually like blade on blade contact. It's a very classical, like we're not actually swinging at each other. We're our target is actually some sort of nebulous third space in between us. And we're just matching swords together, but their physicality while they're doing it is fucking excellent. And this was after or before, he was Legolas after. Yeah.
He got cast because they wanted someone more bankable for, because, you know,
and also somebody that could do the sword fighting.
You
know, cause that's a tough thing to teach people. Actually, speaking of which, one thing that I was really struck by in this rewatch was just watching Johnny Depp try, you know,
right?
Like
I know
watching this performance in particular, he is in such control of what's going on, you know, and like in his sword fight with Barbossa, this what making me think of it is his sword fight with Barbossa. He looks like he's focusing and putting actual effort into it, and while also doing the acting of it all. And I don't think that's a thing we got from Johnny Depp ever again.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
This is the end. This is like the his he peaked It's just like a straight up and straight back down.
He blew up so, I mean, he was always been a very famous actor, but he blew up so hard after this. I think so he fast. Kind of ceased to be like exist in that human category anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it just got weird and weirder with what he would do. And every single time, I think also like the pressure was on where we're like, okay, give us another. And then he just, anything he did that was close to good was took too much from Jack Sparrow.
Yeah.
Cause it's really like, it's not, he only has a, you know.
And then he ran back into Tim Burton land. And I don't think that those guys working together were, pushing either of them, you know.
I don't think
either of them were particularly interested in pushing the envelope anymore. Like watching him sleep through Sweeney Todd.
I do think right after this, the next thing was Once Upon a Time in Mexico, which he's great in, but it's a much more like nuanced, like normal performance. Well, and then the Chocolate Factory.
And I think he was into that because it was because. Once Upon a Time in Mexico was a very down and dirty production. It was
a bunch
of dudes in Mexico just like making shit up on the day. And I think he enjoyed being in that environment. But
I wonder how well that movie has aged, because I loved that when that came out.
Not well.
It's probably in that Boondock Saints kind of category.
Yeah.
It's not in the Boondock Saints category only because it was never as overhyped as Boondock Saints was, where you go back to it after high school thinking it's some piece of like cinematic gold. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, this is garbage and dumb and toxic and dumb. Mm-hmm. Once Upon a Time in Mexico never pretended to be smart. It was mostly intended to be fun.
Yeah.
And you can see how he slid into Grindhouse right after that.
Yeah.
Because he was just like, he was trying to replicate a movie from a past time for the modern age. And he was like, and they just said, fuck it, and just dove straight into Grindhouse world. Robert Rodriguez.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a great performance. And I touched on it earlier, but speaking of performance, just Jeffrey Rush as Barbossa is great.
It's like great. Bringing him back for the sequels was a smart move.
It ruins
a lot, but like I was so excited to have him as a good guy for the third. Like that's just it really doesn't make sense because he's so evil.
But speaking of like Johnny Depp's performance in this is more nuanced than people remember. Jeffrey Rush's performance is just is chewing scenery, but also like there are these targeted moments of just human pathos in his character. Yeah. Just like little shit, like when he's watching Elizabeth eat and just expressions on his face and like little things like that, that just really fill out that character. And again, it's like, I don't care where he came from.
Yeah.
I don't care what he did before this movie started.
I don't even know his first name.
Yeah. And, like,
and the way he winds up being tragic without being sympathetic.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, like his story is very sad. It's a very sad story. A different actor might try to make an audience sympathize with that story. And Jeffrey Rush is like, no, he's a sad, evil man.
Yeah.
You know,
he's a sad, bad man.
He's sad, but he's still evil. He's still, you know, he wants to be alive again so he can,
rape and pillage. Like he still wants to
enjoy feel the pleasure of raping and pillaging as opposed to just going through the motions.
Yeah. Am I just raping because I'm bored?
But his whole like just the way that he does everything with that character is great.
When he says guidelines, the hair on my arm like stands up. It's creepy.
Your return to Shore was not part of our negotiations nor our agreement, so I must do nothing. And secondly, you must be a pirate for the Pirate's Code to apply, and you're not. And thirdly, the code is more what you'd call guidelines than actual rules. Welcome aboard the Black Pearl, Miss Turner.
I am disinclined to acquiesce to your request. Means no.
Yeah, it's fun. And it's deciding to make him like hyper intelligent and like savvy and like a good equal to Jack's strategic mind. Mm-hmm. Like he's a good balance where he has reasons to stand up to all three of the leads, where he's got a sense of propriety and formality that Elizabeth has, where you can read into it like one of two ways, where it's like he is pretending to he wants to be of a higher class, so he like puts on that air, or he came from that and has sort of like he was so violent and awful that he's like been reduced to a pirate life.
But like I said, and like I said, as far as background goes, it doesn't matter. Like the what's in the performance now in that moment is what's important and makes him feel like a living, breathing character and a human being.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing that I miss most about big blockbuster movies these days, of like just like I don't like, yes, spectacle is a major portion of it, but like I also have to care about the people that are involved in the spectacle. Mm-hmm. And right now the only reason that they make you care about them is because, well, it's Batman, or like, oh, it's Ant-Man, and like just care because it's Ant-Man, but like I don't like, give me a reason to care.
And in a self-contained kind of way too. It's not like you care about Ant-Man because you've seen the other two Ant-Man movies.
That's the other problem.
I think that's why Top Gun Maverick hit so well, because you're like, man, I kind of like these people just because of this film versus anything else coming in.
Like you get the beats of the characters, you know who each person is.
It's so refreshing, exactly.
Yeah, in a way that I don't see resonate very much in most of the bigger movies these days, because they're relying on you to know.
You have to come in with having done the homework.
Yeah.
The last thing I'll say that I wanted to flag is they do a lot of fun shots that go kind of unnoticed, and one of them that I want to just call attention to is the first shot of Tortuga, not the establishing shot, the first like camera going through the insanity that is that town. Mm-hmm. And first of all, just full on not even trying to water down that portion of the ride and giving the audience exactly what it would feel like if that was a real place. Brilliant. Yes. But there's a moment where it's the camera's moving along the ground level and you see the ground, you see people walking around, and then it comes up to the first floor balcony of a building. As it comes up, someone takes a person from a bar fight and throws them over the balcony, where you had just seen that there was no mat on the floor. And what they did was, as the camera goes up, the stuntmen pull a mat in once they're out of shot and have a place for that guy to land. So he starts running before there's any place for him to land. And he does like a front flip off the thing. Like, it's that little stuff that really sells the realism of an otherwise like fantastical, insane place.
It goes back to like, you build that world where the rules of that world, as long as they make sense within that world, you're sold, and you don't get caught up on the physics of it all.
It's crazy too, because I don't want to watch it again, but I do want to talk about it, which is Jungle Cruise. That
this is everything Jungle Cruise is not.
That's the thing. Jungle Cruise tries to be identically this, where the plot is basically the exact same plot.
Yeah, it's a curse, and it's a curse, you got to go on an adventure through the
undead and whatever. Like, and it's so egregiously the same that it's fascinating to watch them side by side and see how much one fails at everything that this movie succeeds with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not least of which, because I don't care about the characters that much.
I kind of want to also go back and watch Cutthroat Island again. Just sort of start there, go to Pirates of the Caribbean, and then Jungle Cruise. Just sort of get less and less analog as you go. That's another movie that blew up a boat. The ship raiding scene too. Sort of getting at what you were saying. You know, all the people swinging, you know, the one after they do the handbrake turn in the sea.
Yeah, the boat to boat battle.
Yeah. You know, again, that's sort of that analog thing you were talking about of you know, it's just a camera in a space with smoke and guys that are fighting each other. Like, it's not. And even the section where the redcoats are fighting the skeletons still has that sort of feel, like that lack of bloodfulness that so many sort of CGI flubber.
Because there's a mass to that interaction that doesn't tend to. Yeah,
actually, there's a cool one of the cool behind the scenes things that I remember from that era is the way that they choreographed that fight, because they had.
Oh, I remember this. Yeah.
They choreographed the fight for everybody that's on the deck. They shot a version where the guys in the British, the Marines, I guess, were fighting Marines. Guys dressed up like pirates. And then they shot it again without the guys dressed up like pirates. So it was like, it was this sort of like one sided fights that they shot, which looks hilarious.
I can imagine
in the raw footage,
man. And it's also like, it's, not that this movie is terribly exotic in its locations, and you know, it's a lot of like fake Tortuga's all a set soundstage and stuff, yeah. But like, goddamn, do I miss just having seen a movie where like the crew traveled somewhere to shoot it? Like, holy shit.
To see that turquoise water and
there's a lot of green screen stuff, especially that one shot when the governor first opens the window, which I think looks amazing, but like clearly that's a fictional spot. But like, goddamn, like going to the island where they get marooned and like being on the water, and like it just like the whole point of these sort of like far off adventure movies is like to take the camera there.
Yeah, because people can't go there. Yeah.
If every background, if every leaf is digitally rendered and every animal is digitally rendered, like what are you? I feel nothing. Like you, I need to see some longitude and latitude I haven't seen before.
I got that feeling the first time you see Keira Knightley on the ship during the day. I think it's after they rescue her. And they're fleeing, and you can see the sun shining on her face and the wind in her hair, and you can almost sort of just feel like
the salt air
of the salt air, like in the texture of her skin. Granted, I was watching the 4K on Disney Plus, so that might have had something to do with it.
It's such a down and dirty movie where it's like this was, like with any movie on the water, a fucking bitch to make. The scene where Jack and Will steal the interceptor and ride off with it.
Oh, God.
Is a complete fucked shot that they saved by rolling the camera. If you look close, what happened was like they had the ship set up. They weren't ready to shoot yet, but everything was like prepped. A gust of wind came in and like shoved the interceptor forwards. And if you look, all the ropes are still attached and everything's still connected and they aren't supposed to be. So they started to lose a ship, and it takes hours to reset all that stuff. And they're losing sunlight. So Gore Verbinski screamed for them to start rolling. And if you look, it's a complete mess of a shot. All the ropes break apart. A piece of the ship flies off and hits Johnny Depp in the knee. And he spends the rest of that scene like holding onto the wheel because he can't stand on his own. Like, it's crazy how messy this movie was and how awful it was to sort of, and that's why you see all, like any movie that they do this to, either the people refuse to come back or they make it way more comfortable for them in the second one, third.
Yeah.
Which is why it becomes like bloodless CGI.
Yeah. I think 2 and 3 do a fairly okay job, at least feeling as real of locations. 2 and 3 have some of the best visual effects I've ever seen in them. But like 2, it feels like they were traveling and going around. And then I know 4 and 5, I think they shot in like London and or Hawaii. But it's always fun. It's always a fun watch.
The one thing, and after we watched this last night, I showed Katie the first 2 episodes of Black Sails, and the thing that I could not take my eyes off were how perfect everyone's teeth were in that show compared with just like the modeled everything that was in this movie.
Yeah. The pirate makeup is just, it looks really so uncomfortable just to be those people. Yeah. You know, like everybody's
look grotesque without the CGI skeleton stuff. Yeah. Like
this is the thing I noticed this time, all of the whites of all the pirates' eyes are yellow.
Yeah,
because they have liver failure, I imagine.
Yeah. They're jaundiced. Yeah, and just like that moment where I forget who he's talking to, but where Barbossa like looks, and it's just a shot of him where he turns and just smiles that terrible toothy.
Oh yeah,
agreed.
There's a cut on a small like cut on Johnny Depp's chin that was like an in joke with him and the makeup person, where all movie it just gets worse and worse. And he's like,
I was wondering about that.
Yeah. So it's a cut that he's like, he's outside and like the salt water just keeps it from healing. Like it doesn't heal over because of the movie. So it just.
What I read, because I also clocked that and looked it up, was that it was an in joke with the makeup department that it was a sore from syphilis.
Oh, well. Well, I mean, you heard the thing about what Johnny Depp wanted to do with this character.
No.
He wanted Jack Sparrow to have lost his nose previously
right.
and have it sewn back on, but it doesn't have circulation, so it's sewn on and it's like blue.
Rotting off.
It's rotting off. And the director had to be like, okay, maybe. Or it's
when you could still rein him in.
That's also like a perfect combination of bringing in Jerry Bruckheimer and that level of sort of the Michael Bay-isms of it, and then the like sheen of Disney with a property that like no one believed in. So no corporate people were like, no, 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 that character can't do that. Like no one like it was just a perfect storm to get something through that was so refreshing with the gloss of like big budget, which is just rarer and rarer.
Yeah.
We won't see it's like again.
Nope.
Well, Pirate 6 is it's in pre. Will
not until the whole system comes crashing down and we have to build it back up.
Yeah.
The last thing I want to flag, my favorite thing happens in this movie when characters that are out of sync with each other suddenly get perfectly in sync with each other, and that's the end fight scene.
Oh,
when,
yes.
Will saves Jack from getting hung, and the their teamwork in that fight almost made me cry. Because that kind of, I am such a sucker for that moment. It's also the Warner in Avengers when they're all finally working together, and like Iron Man lands on the ground and shoots his beams into the Captain America's shield, and he redirects them to it. That kind of thing always makes me makes me emotional. And this particular one was that, and I forgot that it was in there, and it made me very happy.
It's it's Hook and Rufio back to back. It's fun. A thing that none of the pirate sequels care to even bother doing between those two characters. They never work together again in any meaningful way.
Honestly, that's like the most disappointing. Now that I'm thinking about it, it's the most disappointing aspect of the whole thing.
They literally play it like neither of them actually likes the other person in 2 and 3. And it's strange.
When they're like almost they're not quite actively friends at the end of the first one, but they are close. They're pretty close. Yeah.
They're at least sort of like can rely on each other. Yeah. They know the other one can handle their own.
Right. Well, and there's also like the arc of Will Turner becoming a competent pirate too. And Captain Jack's acknowledgement of that, which I think says more about me than it does in the movie.
William, nice hat.
Well, I think, that's the reason the ending kind of works well is because it's been set up that Jack has done the math of like, okay, this guy can hold his own. I can make sure that like I'm not alone in this cave at the end. Like he's sort of like has the information to pull off the final act based on like what he's learned throughout the movie.
Yeah.
So he's I want to say savvy, but it feels a little on the nose.
On the rotten nose that was reattached.
On yes. On good. The rotten nose.
Good movie, guys. Good movie.
Yeah, good movie. Good pirate.
It's fun watching good movies. And not a bummer. Not a bummer. Not a single bummer.
No, not a bummer at all. Just two and a half hours of escapism that was actually fairly well crafted.
Really well crafted. I would say expertly crafted.
Yeah.
Expertly crafted. I think so. So, yeah. Happy summer. I don't know. I got nothing.
Hags.
Cabin fever.
That's going at the end.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah, that was kind of weird, but we're back in the club. Buying up the bar so the groupies show us love. Motherfucking Iceman, I'm the top gunner. Heater on blast, I'm the number one stunner. Watch it, girl, because I ain't your Mr. Nice Guy. More